Hello there and Happy New Year. Today is Tuesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new concerns over North Korea's nukes.
I think it's entirely possible, perhaps even likely, that North Korea is very close to nuclear breakout.
Donald Trump tweets again, this time aimed at North Korea. The amount of food wasted in the U.S., astonishing. Also ahead, a robot finds colorful life under the Antarctic ice. It's all on today's International Edition. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility on Monday for a New Year's attack on a nightclub in Istanbul, Turkey, that left 39 people dead and authorities searching for a shooter who got away. Turkish authorities say they are close to identifying a gunman. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with Charlie Winter, research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College, London.
Based on the claim of responsibility that the Islamic State has produced, they are trying to brand it as something that has been centrally directed rather than an attack which is being carried out by a supporter who's perhaps spoken with individuals within the Islamic State and they've egged them on to carry out a stabbing attack or something like that. In this instance, the Islamic State is saying, we ordered this, one of our operatives carried this out, and it is something which was orchestrated from within Syria or Iraq. So that matters because it points towards a logistics network, it points towards much more complicated planning, and I think it's all geared towards potentially representing a sea change in the Islamic State's agitation in Turkey. This is a point which it's trying to make through this attack. It's saying the years where we've been kind of having a fairly ambiguous presence in your country are over, and now the war is being brought to you. And this is something which has come through a lot in the Islamic State's propaganda over the last few months.
Why Turkey?
Why Turkey? Well, I mean, there are a load of reasons, really, but one of the key ones right now is the fact that the Turkish army is involved in northern Syria and actually making serious headway against the Islamic State in what has been a very, very important province or area that's been under its control for a number of years now. So Aleppo province is shrinking by the day, and that is having a profound impact upon the Islamic State organization and its insurgency in Syria, and with a knock-on effect in Iraq as well. So what the Islamic State needs to do is show that it is still a potent force and show that there is no encroachment on its territory without retribution. So this is an attack where it's trying to say, look, we're still in the game, and no matter how much land you take away from us in northern Syria, we will fight back. But as well as that, it's of course trying to just get into the headlines on its own terms. This is propaganda of the deed. It's propaganda which is essentially aiming to draw attention to the Islamic State cause, but point towards a consistent level of momentum and sustain this idea of triumphalism, that the Islamic State is moving forward, that it is more threatening than ever, and that it is still a viable jihadist organization. It's always thinking about what its audiences think of it. And we have to think of its terrorism as an extension of its propaganda in that sense.
And apparently in this statement that Islamic State issued, it says that this attack was made in response to an order of, I believe he's called the Emir, who is its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Yes, so the statement does specifically say that the attack was carried out in accordance with or in response to an order from Amir al-Mu'mineen, so the Prince of the Believers, which is another title given to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State. And, I mean, I think, yes, that's clear that they're trying to draw a direct line between the Islamic State organization and the attacker. But I think we can also take that with a bit of a pinch of salt. I don't think that there was actually a direct order given. You could interpret that as just saying the individual who carried out the attack listened to a speech made by Baghdadi a couple of months ago, and then he carried out the attack in response to what Baghdadi said within those lines.
That's Charles Winter, research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College, London. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Obama plans a farewell speech next week in his hometown of Chicago. Trump aides tamp down expectations about new disclosures on Russian hacking. Congress ushers in a new era of all-Republican rule. SpaceX aims for a January 8th return to flight with the Falcon rocket. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President-elect Donald Trump insists North Korea won't develop a nuclear weapon capable of reaching the United States. He addressed the issue Monday evening on Twitter. The tweet followed comments by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on Sunday in his annual New Year's address when he said preparations for launching an intercontinental ballistic missile have reached the final stage. It's not clear if Trump meant he would stop North Korea or was simply doubting the country's capabilities. VOA's Victor Beatty talked about this and more with Sung-Yoon Lee, assistant professor of Korean studies at Tufts University in Boston.
When you think of the trajectory of North Korea's nuclear weapons and long-range ballistic missile programs over the past 20 years or so, I think it's entirely possible, perhaps even likely, that North Korea is very close to nuclear breakout and attaining that capability of shooting off a missile with a nuclear warhead that can hit the mainland United States. So rather than underestimating or patronizing North Korea, I would err on the side of caution and take Kim Jong-un's threat very seriously and really brace for an imminent, perhaps a very soon, such a missile test, a flight test of a ballistic missile. It could come even in January. January 8th is Kim Jong-un's birthday. Last year, we remember, he conducted his fourth nuclear test, the country's fourth nuclear test, and then followed up a month later with yet another long-range missile test. So that's a serious threat. And Mr. Trump probably took the right tone, but it's very unconvincing. I don't think the United States can really stop North Korea's machinations, North Korea's designs.
What kind of policy change is necessary?
We have at least a quarter century of documented failed policy, I would say. All conventional approach to North Korea, negotiations with a bit of sanctions here and there, that has not worked. North Korea has marched down the nuclear path, and we are a lot worse off today than we were, say, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly 25 years ago. We have a long laundry list of mistakes to take into consideration, and I would suggest that conventional diplomacy, being nice, giving the right price or blandishments to North Korea will not work, and we have to put real pressure on North Korea's pressure points, really strangle North Korea's vulnerabilities, preponderant dependence on illicit streams of revenue, go after the money, constrict North Korea's financial transactions, implement secondary sanctions against North Korea's third country enablers, partners. And this is nothing radical. It's what the U.S. and other countries, the EU, have done with respect to Iran, Burma, Syria, and other countries. This is something that the U.S. has shied away from, but this, there is no more option. There is no more time to wait around. And I think the Trump administration should see that the growing North Korean lethal threat is something that must be addressed directly.
That's Sung-Yoon Lee, assistant professor of Korean studies at Tufts University. Well, Donald Trump is naming a record number of generals and billionaire business executives to his proposed cabinet. The business nominations reflect this his oft-stated belief that titans of commerce and industry can do more good for America than career civil servants and politicians. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the evolving composition of the incoming administration, though, is raising some eyebrows.
Donald Trump's proposed inner circle will feature at least three generals, including James Mattis, to lead the Pentagon. Mattis is no stranger to Capitol Hill.
Are we demonstrating a decisive form of leadership, or are we demonstrating impotence?
Trump has also named five billionaire investors and corporate executives for top posts, including ExxonMobil chief Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State.
Rex will be a fierce advocate for America's interests around the world.
But advocacy is a duty Tillerson has shunned as a leader in the petroleum industry.
Whether it's Russia or Yemen or, you know, wherever, the Middle East, I'm not here to represent the United States government's interest. I'm not here to defend it, nor am I here to criticize it. That's not what I do. I'm a businessman.
It does concern me just the number of generals and billionaires in Donald Trump's picks for his nominees for the cabinet.
Democrat Chris Coons serves on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Donald Trump will be the first American president in our entire nation's history with no previous public service, either an elected service or military service. And he needs to surround himself with folks who understand the strengths of the American civil service.
In 1961, President Dwight Eisenhower issued a warning about the very forces that will be prominent in the Trump administration.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
According to Trump, there is nothing to fear.
I believe we're in the process of putting together one of the great cabinets. Certainly a cabinet with the highest IQ.
Republican lawmakers are mostly supportive of Trump's picks so far.
I think General Mattis is an outstanding choice for defense. I'm optimistic the president's going to have a good national security team.
This is a corporatist White House. We have elected a CEO.
Analyst Hudak says Trump's choices are unsurprising but could lead to pitfalls.
Typically, when a general wants something done, it gets done. When a CEO wants something done, it gets done. That's not necessarily true in the American bureaucracy. The cabinet picks are going to find out very quickly how different life inside the Beltway is compared to the lives that they have led.
Senate Democrats do not have the votes to block Trump nominees by themselves, but are pressing them to make full financial disclosures, including their tax returns, something the president-elect has yet to divulge. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Well, it's time now to take a look at what's been trending on social media with G. Abby Lee, who's been on vacation. Welcome back, G.
Thanks so much, Lori. Good to be back. First up is a definition of partying. It all started when reporter Soap & Deb tweeted that NBC host Joe Scarborough had quote-unquote partied with President-elect Donald Trump at a New Year's Eve event. And did Scarborough have a reaction? He accused Deb of pushing fake news, and when pressed about whether or not he attended the same event as Trump, Scarborough answered he did not attend the party, but rather walked through metal detectors and around the area where the guests were. So basically saying that he just did his job.
Okay, well, it's hard to know because we've heard rumblings that Joe Scarborough was actually kind of buddies. Mm-hmm. The news journalist was actually buddies with Donald Trump outside of
NBC.
Kind of media relationship, which is interesting because it's such a liberal-leaning...
Right. That's not the station you immediately connect Donald Trump with.
Right, for sure.
And then there's this cartoon from the New Yorker magazine. In it, a person stands in the middle of an airplane and says, "These smug pilots have lost touch with regular passengers like us. Who thinks I should fly the plane?" And that person gets a lot of support from other passengers. Some say the cartoonists capture the political climate very well.
Okay.
But others say the cartoon depicts U.S. President-elect Donald Trump in an unfairly... harsh light. Many people are also arguing that actually a more accurate cartoon would be a bunch of people forced to vote between two pilots that aren't taking anyone where they want to go.
Wow. Okay. Well, beyond politics, which everybody's talking about as the inauguration gets closer and closer, what else? Is there anything else happening on social media we should know about?
Yes, and this one is outside of the U.S. There was a prison riot in Brazil that killed at least 60 people, and it was caused by fighting between rival gangs. There is no specific hashtag for the incident, but a good person to follow for the developing story is Gabriel Elizondo, I probably butchered his name, who is a correspondent for Al Jazeera English. In one of his latest tweets, he wrote, "Possibly 130 inmates escaped, in addition to the rising death toll." Lori?
All right, G, thanks so much. You can follow her at G Abby Lee. Well, a new report from the Natural Resources Defense Council has brought to light just how much food is wasted across the United States. The report, Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill, shows some pretty disturbing results on the amount of food thrown away in this country. Joining me now to talk more about it is the author of the report, senior scientist Dana Gunders. So how much food do we waste?
We waste an enormous amount of food in this country. About 40% of all the food never gets eaten. And it's a huge problem because not only are we investing a huge amount of resources in that food, and we're talking about 25% of our water going to grow food that never gets eaten, but also it's the number one product going into our landfills today. And when it gets there, it rots, decomposes, and creates methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas.
Why are we wasting so much food? Is there more than one reason?
There's so many reasons that food is going to waste around the country. It's everything from things that aren't getting harvested off the farms because maybe prices are too low or they don't look quite right, all the way through to product that doesn't sell in the grocery store in time, potatoes on our breakfast platter that we don't eat, or lettuce that leave to go bad in our fridges.
Well, I understand that you have just started a new program to try to combat some of this food waste. Tell us about it.
We do. Well, we work on combating food waste in a number of ways. We work with cities to try to help them help their businesses and residents waste less. But we also are trying to work directly with consumers to help people understand what they can do to waste less in their own kitchens and in their own lives. To do this, we have a book out called The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook that is meant to be information and inspiration to waste less, all the way down to the very specifics of kind of what to do with a wrinkled tomato when you're standing there in your kitchen and not sure if you should throw it out or not. And we also have a large media campaign that we are conducting around the country to really try to raise awareness on the issue and inspire people to just think a little bit more before they go ahead and throw food out.
And I know you're also doing something a little bit unique with expiration labels. Tell us about it.
Those labels that you see on food here in the U.S., the Best Buy, Use Buy, sell by, those labels are not actually regulated, nor are they about the food safety or telling you that the food is bad. They're really just indicators of when the food is at its freshest or peak quality. However, a lot of people don't understand that and wind up throwing food away on that date out of fear that it has spoiled or might make them sick. And in fact, about 9 out of 10 Americans report occasionally throwing food away prematurely because of this. And so we are really trying to standardize the way that dates are expressed on food across the country to help reduce the confusion that's out there.
It's interesting because that's one of the things you do when you go to the grocery store. You look, you check the label, you always want the newest one. Sometimes the newer ones are in the back and you'll go back there and take a newer one because you think you're getting something fresher. It's interesting to hear you say that it may not necessarily be so cut and dry.
Right. I mean, I think, something that has a later, if you're looking at the same product and one has a later date and one has an earlier date, well, that with the later date is probably a little bit fresher. But what we're really trying to get through is that once it hits its date, that doesn't mean it's bad. And as long as it looks fine and smells fine, especially a product like milk or cheese really should be fine to eat.
You think about countries around the world where people are just literally starving, it's really uncomfortable to hear how much food we waste here in the U.S. It seems like we'd want to take all this food waste and somehow ship it over to people who really need it. How do we come to terms with that?
Well, I think that's a great point. And, when you really look at the big picture of why we should be wasting less food, it is a global problem because we are facing an increased population and along with that increased food demand. And we really are stretched in terms of the resources to produce that food. So when you look ahead towards 2050, for instance, the United Nations predicts we will need 60% more food by then to feed that population. And so really figuring out ways to streamline our food system, to be more efficient, in our own kitchens, and just more cognizant and respectful of the food that we have can in the end really add up to a world food economy that is using its food to the best.
That's Dana Gunder, senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council. We appreciate it. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, beneath the ice at the South Pole, an underwater robot has observed an explosion of colorful sea life. VOA's Steve Barragona brings us a look.
When you think of life in Antarctica, you think penguins, seals, whales.
But when you get under the sea ice and onto the seafloor, that's where all the color is, where all the biodiversity is.
Glenn Johnstone and colleagues at the Australian Antarctic Division sent a robot down for a look. Once they got past a curious seal, and through a meter and a half of ice, they found a stunning landscape of color rivaling any tropical reef.
So all of that color that you're seeing there, all of the organisms of different marine invertebrate groups there, are the same ones that you might see if you went for a snorkel or a dive on a reef in Tasmania or in northern Australia or anywhere in Australia or anywhere in the world.
It's cold but sheltered beneath the ice, a constant minus 1.5 degrees Celsius. For now, anyway. The carbon dioxide released from burning fossil fuels is warming the planet. It's also making the oceans more acidic.
So we're doing an experiment there to look at the effects of ocean acidification on Antarctic marine fauna.
The greenhouse gases endangering life above the ice may also threaten creatures living below it. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Well, a new film based on the acclaimed children's novel A Monster Calls opens this month. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the film tells the story of a boy coming to terms with his mother's terminal illness.
Connor O'Malley has been plagued by nightmares. The 13-year-old shy, artistic boy is also the victim of his school bully. At 7 minutes past midnight, Connor keeps hearing a voice call to him from his bedroom window, which overlooks a churchyard with a giant yew tree. One night, Connor meets a monster, a massive tangle of roots and branches in human form. The monster tells Connor that he summoned it, and it will help him by telling him three short stories. In return, Connor must tell stories of his own. As Connor and the monster continue to meet, almost always at 12:07 a.m., we learn that Connor's mother, played by Felicity Jones, has terminal cancer. Connor is forced to move in with his cold, emotionally detached grandmother, played by Sigourney Weaver. The monster's stories are intended to teach the boy about life, but they continue to have increasing consequences, including the smashing of his grandmother's living room and the attacking of his nemesis at school. Liam Neeson provides the voice of the monster.
I don't know if you've read the book by Patrick Ness. It's an extraordinary, it really is like a classic book. And I just, you close over the last page, and certainly with me, it just really gets you thinking about aspects of your life.
When Connor tells his own nightmare, he begins to confront his feelings about his mother's imminent death. The monster reveals that he has been sent to help Connor heal, and when the boy accepts his mother's terminal illness, she dies in the hospital at 7 minutes after midnight. Newcomer Lewis McDougall plays Connor.
Well, I guess really I would use experiences in my own life to try and understand what Connor's feeling, but you know, also there was the fact that I had to do an English accent, which I'm Scottish, of course, and so I had to do a bit of dialect coaching for that, and I actually had a couple of weeks of rehearsals with everybody, including Liam, and so that was very helpful.
Neeson says that MacDougall embodied the nuances and the emotions Connor experiences in a way not usually seen in child actors.
Terrific kid, and what a performance he gives. I mean, I've made quite a few movies with quite a few children. This boy is brilliant. He really is. It's a brilliant performance.
Sigourney Weaver says that she, director J.A. Bayona, and Felicity Jones did their homework to make sure that their performances were true to life.
You know, Felicity and I, and Bayona, we did meet with doctors in England, cancer specialists. We also went to hospice to see what the challenges of taking care of someone in the last stages of cancer would be. So we did kind of fill up on that, and I know she also met with women survivors of cancer.
A Monster Calls is based on the book by Patrick Ness, who also wrote the Chaos Walking series for children. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. Thank you so much for joining us. That does it for today's show, but you can join us anytime at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to protecting religious minorities, their communities, and their culture worldwide. This is an important expression of the values of the United States, in that we want to protect diversity of thought and belief, said Knox Thames, Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South Central Asia. This effort, said Special Advisor Thames, is of great importance in Syria and Iraq, where ISIL or Daesh seek to wipe out much of civilizational history.
In that work, we saw where Daesh was committing genocidal acts against Christians, Yazidis, and Shia Muslims. At the same time that they were killing people, they were also trying to erase any evidence that they ever existed, destroying their churches, their mosques, their cemeteries. And if we were going to defeat Daesh militarily, we also need to take steps to protect the places that matter to these people that they're also trying to exterminate. And so from that work, we started focusing on protecting the cultural heritage of religious minorities.
The U.S. State Department partnered with the Smithsonian Institution to engage religious minority groups directly, providing them with training and information on preserving cultural sites and objects that are at risk. Some of these preventative methods are simple but effective, said Special Advisor Thames.
There was a training that went on in northern Syria where churches were trained about how to stack sandbags in front of ancient frescoes and murals so that if a mortar shell were to land, the explosive force would be dissipated by the sandbags. It wouldn't hurt the mural. And they had these very striking before and after pictures of a room full of sandbags, the bomb tragically hit, the sandbags are exploded, but the mural is fine.
Trainings also include information on protecting movable artifacts by creating digital documentation of the items that can be stored remotely. The Smithsonian Institute has created a special outreach program in Erbil, Iraq, that is dedicated to the effort. These communities that are so unique, that create this mosaic of culture and religion, said Special Advisor Thames, they can be pieced together, and protecting their common culture can be a way to do that.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.